A Life Well Lived. Local artist Cedric Hustis shares his early childhood experiences in Hawaii and being out in his yard when Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, we learn about Cedric's many travels, his love of art and music, and a new coffee table book in the works. And who's Cedric's biggest fan and critic? His wife, of course, who has the credentials to keep him drawing within the lines. We'll also hear about Granny Magoon and other characters in Old Hawaii, and December 7th, 1941, when Cedric Hustis was an eyewitness to the start of World War II. 2 Main Street is next. What was life like growing up in Hawaii before it became our 50th state, then becoming a respected lawyer, nationally recognized race walker, member of the Philharmonic Orchestra, and, oh, by the way, a prolific artist with works on display in public buildings and private homes around the world? I'm David James, and from the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, this is 2 Main Street. My guest is Cedric Hustis, a life well lived, and now working on a new project. So, Cedric, welcome to 2 Main Street. And before we get to any, all of this, you grew up in Hawaii, your childhood there. Where were you on December 7th, 1941, Cedric?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I was fighting the Japanese. I was 7 years old. I was out in my yard wearing a helmet, probably made in Japan, and with my toy rifle, probably also made in Japan, and trying to shoot down the little black dots in the sky, which were the planes that were leaving. They had already dropped their loads of bombs and strafing, so they were high up in the sky. And until I was well on my way for a military career, until my mother told me to get back in the house. And what was falling around us were anti-aircraft shells that had been sent up so fast that they hadn't been fused properly. So instead of exploding up in the sky, they were exploding when they came back down.
So they were falling in the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So you were in Honolulu.
Yes.
How far from Pearl Harbor?
We're about 10 miles from Pearl
Really?
Harbor.
Really? Yes. So when did you realize, your family realize something was going on?
Well, we realized it early on, because my oldest brother, Frank Hustis, was a shave-tail lieutenant in the Army Reserve. So he got a phone call telling him, report. We didn't know where he went until much later, but he had to report, so we knew there was an attack. And then we heard it on the radio, too. They brought broadcast, and so we were advised there was an attack.
So was there any damage to your neighborhood?
Yeah, we had several shells that landed near us, and there was a school about two blocks away that had a direct hit, either a bomb or an anti-aircraft shell, and was just burned to the ground. Fortunately for the school, it was Sunday. No students, so there was nobody hurt. But so there was some damage, yeah.
So what were the days like after the attack?
Well, we had an immediate order of a blackout. So all windows had to be blacked out with newspapers or whatever we had. And then my father worked for the Hawaiian Electric Company. So on Pearl Harbor Day, he was out helping to restore power to the military. But so anyhow, he was here and there, and he started to dig a bomb shelter, and which is pretty rough in Hawaii, because we had quite a bit of rain, you know. But so we had a bomb shelter, and that was just pretty much life as it until we left in February of 42.
So now, were there fears that there might be an invasion?
Yeah, that's that. My dad was afraid. He would never leave the islands. He would never. And he was working for the electric company, so he had a
essential job.
Yeah, but he would never. But he wanted my mother to take us little kids out of the islands because he had heard what the Japanese had done to the Chinese, and it was horrible. And so in February of 42, we were on a convoy that went to San Francisco. And the ship we were on was a sister ship of the Lusitania, which was the Aquitania. Beautiful, beautiful ship. The outside was all camouflage, but the inside was all this wonderful woodwork. You know, just like the Titanic type of thing. And so that was a big convoy we were in. And the North Pacific in February can get really rough. So we had really rough seas.
So this was a grand adventure for a young boy.
Yeah, it was a grand adventure. That's right. We got to San Francisco, and I've got to say, the American Red Cross was not at the dock to meet us, but the Salvation Army was. And the Salvation Army gave each of us a woolen sweater. And so I always donate to the Salvation Army.
That was only
warm clothing I had. And we stayed up in Northern California with some friends of the family for several days before we headed out going east. And that was the first time I ever saw snow. We didn't know where it was.
So when did you return back to Hawaii?
We came back after the war ended. So we were back there in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to school there to junior high school. So that was 7th and 8th. And then my mother thought we could get a better education back in Texas where we had stayed part of the war. So we went back to El Paso, Texas, and that's where I went to high school and then undergraduate school.
Mm-hmm. And I know I've been looking at your recent artwork that you've been posting on Facebook. A lot of memories of Hawaii.
Yes.
Old Hawaii.
Yes.
And with each of these pictures, you have a little narrative about your experiences in Hawaii. And I know, who is Granny Magoon?
That was my maternal grandmother. And she was part Chinese. I'm 1/8 Chinese. I guess I'm really a minority. I could probably, but no benefits, you know. Anyhow, so Granny Magoon, she was really a nice person, cantankerous as could be. And so she had a cattle ranch on the Big Island of Hawaii, on South Kona. And she was in her 70s. She'd be out riding horses with roundups, and she'd been known to use a pistol if the need arose to break up a fight or whatever.
Were there any rustlers in Hawaii?
But not that I knew of. They could have been, but it's such a small place, you know.
Well, and also you talk about there were cattle boats that would transport the livestock back and forth to the different islands.
We went to see Granny Magoon, her ranch in 1939. And so my mother took my brother David, who was 4 years older than I, and me, up to see Granny Magoon. So we caught the cattle boat because that was the only boat that would make the stops along the Kona coast. So it was the cattle boat called the SS Humu'ula. And to this day, I can still smell and I think I can taste the crude oil from that ship. It was really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rough water. The channels are always rough water. And so much so that the captain wouldn't even let us come up on deck. We had to stay in our stateroom. And so when the ship then anchored at the town closest to where my grandmother lived, it was a little town called Ho'okena on the Kona coast. The ship lowered a longboat, and the hardy Hawaiian seamen rowed us ashore over the breakers, you know. It was quite an experience.
Well, what a fascinating childhood you had, Cedric.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these adventures, and of course, were you a surfer, or was that in vogue?
I did some surfing, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that was after the war.
Yeah. What about fishing?
I didn't really do any fishing. My my uncles were great fishermen. And in fact, they would go out on small boats separately and way out. They had spots. They could triangulate where the fishing sites were. And one time, one of the uncles, his engine conked out and a storm was developing. So he asked the other uncle for a tow back to port. And the other uncle said, I'll give you a tow, but only if I get half of the catch. They're characters.
Well, we're talking to Cedric Huestis, Evansville resident, a life well lived. We're talking about his early life in Hawaii, and of course, a prolific artist as well. You have a new coffee table book in the works, is that
yes.
right?
Yes. I had been asked by Barnes & Noble for years to do a coffee table book, and I just never got around to doing it. So now I'm working with my daughter, Joan Huestis Walker, who is a prolific author and a good editor. So she's my editor. And our son, Curtis, he's a photographer and also my archivist. So he supplies all the high-res images. And so now what we've done is we've retained a layout artist who will put the thing together. And so, we're working on this. It will probably be the end of the year before we have mm-hmm. it in publish.
Now, will you provide a narrative in this book?
Yes. Yeah. Like each photograph will have a little vignette of what it's about. And like I posted one on Facebook today of the Royal Barracks in Honolulu. And that is a little vignette about when it was constructed and what it was used for and what it's used for today.
Now, I've been to Honolulu and seen the palace.
Yes.
It's quite a remarkable building.
It really
is. Built
in
the 1800s, I believe.
Yes.
By when it was a royal family there.
Oh, yes. It's the only royal palace in the United States.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, Hawaii has an incredible history that a lot of people really don't remember or don't know and didn't read about in school. And it was a thriving kingdom at one time. And then the Americans showed up,
and
then the rest is history.
Yeah. My aunties, my grand aunties on my father's side, they all spoke fluent Hawaiian. And they were at the royalty level,
mm-hmm.
so they love the Hawaiians. No one in my family was any missionary. They were all adventurers. In fact, I could tell you a story about
Ahead.
Me and the Methodist minister. This was a number of years ago, and the Methodist minister was at some function, a very polite function, tea or something like that. And he came up to me and he said, you are from Hawaii, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, are you from missionary stock? And I said, no, my family used to eat the missionaries. Well, needless to say, the conversation flatlined. And Carol, my wife, started kicking my leg. Well, why do you tell that story? So I'm part Hawaiian, too.
Yeah. That's what. Now, what is the banana wagon? I know you mentioned that, too.
Well, that was an early station wagon. It was owned by my maternal grandmother that she would have for loading supplies and take it to the ranch. And it was just an old station wagon, but it was a wood-paneled station wagon. And they used to haul bananas and stuff. We call it the banana wagon.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you have paintings of most of these items.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Not one of that, but I have mm-hmm. paintings from that area.
Now, the coffee table book we talked about, is that just Hawaii? Or?
This volume will be just Hawaii.
Okay.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, at last count, I think I have over 75 images,
mm-hmm.
and so maybe some of those won't be able to be used, space available.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it may require a second volume. We'll see how the first one sells.
Now, I was wondering which artist maybe influenced you. I know the Paul Gauguin; he painted a lot of French Polynesia, And he was kind of an impressionist. Any influenced there?
Of course, one of the ones I really like is Van Gogh. I'm not in that style, but I'm an impressionist style. Yeah, that's for sure. But I don't know. And I like a lot of color, so that's why any artist that uses a lot of color is something I look at, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you always liked to draw and paint?
Ever since I was a kid, that's right. I would get the comic books. Mm-hmm. There was like Red Rider and Terry and the Pirates and any comic book that had good motion, and then I would copy it with my pencil, you know, the figures. So that's why I knew how to do figure drawing from the comic books and motion. And that's why a lot of my paintings have people in them, and where there's motion, and that's why I've done athletic scenes and competitions, mm-hmm. and because I can do motion, mm-hmm. and I'm also I like to do a lot of portrait work too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, do you do commission portraits?
Yeah, that.
That pays the bills?
Yes, that would be a high price.
Oh, good. So now, okay, we've got you in Hawaii. You were transported to the mainland during the World War II, went back. Then you returned the mainland to go to school.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, how did you end up in Evansville, Cedric Eustis?
Well, long story, but what it was, got my undergraduate degree from Texas Western College, which is now University of Texas at El Paso. I thought, well, I was going to go to law school. So I tried the University of California in Berkeley, and I didn't care for that. I guess too many hippies out in Berkeley or something. I don't know. Anyhow, so I decided to get my military commitment out of the way. So I joined the Army for 3 years in the regular Army, and that way I could get my choice of places where I wanted to be stationed, relatively. And I didn't pick the Pacific, because I knew the Pacific, it wouldn't be Hawaii. It would probably be Guam or Wake Island or something like that. So I chose Europe, and so then I was stationed in Heidelberg, Germany, which was wonderful, in the headquarters. And in Heidelberg, since I already had my degree, I was then selected to be the administrative guy for the political advisor from the U.S. Embassy in Bonn. And so that was like a three-man office. The political advisor, Sed Eustis, is his admin man, and our German driver. It was a good,
good
tour of duty. And then with the political advisor is a guy by the name of Denny Flynn, brilliant fellow. He was a super spy, he was. And he was friends of ours to the day he died.
This during the Cold War?
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Well, it was interesting. Carol and I, after we were married, we were married in Germany, in mm-hmm. Heidelberg. We would be invited by Denny Flynn and his wife to go to functions where there were officer functions, you know, like 3 and 4 star generals, and we were in civilian clothes. He said, just don't tell anybody your rank, because I was an enlisted man, see. And so we would go, there was some general's wife was talking about things going on in Eastern Europe. And my boss looked at me, and I looked at him, and we didn't say anything, but it was classified stuff that only she would know if she had it from her husband. So it was highly classified. We were in a spy office, basically.
My guest is local artist, world traveler, Cedric Eustis. Cedric's other interests include race walking, music, and the law. We'll hear about his two whippets, Amber and Jade.
That's correct.
Amber and Jade. And we'll hear some questions from a fellow artist who happens to be my daughter.
Good.
And she gave me some questions for you, Cedric, and we'll pose those to you later.
Good.
We'll be right back. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Cedric Huestis, local artist, world traveler, legal eagle, former race walker, musician, and storyteller. And we were talking earlier about you were in Hawaii during the attack on Pearl Harbor, and your brother was at the Army field?
Yeah, well, I had two brothers that were in the military. My brother Frank was a lieutenant, so he had to report. It turned out to be he had to report to the command center that was located in the bunkers under the volcano Diamond Head near Waikiki. So we didn't know whether he was alive or dead or where he was or anything. My other brother, Richard, had just finished basic training at Schofield Barracks in Wahiwa on the island of Oahu. And Schofield Barracks is where they had the movie From Here to Eternity. And so years later, I asked Richard, well, what did you do on the day of the attack? And he said, well, the planes came over because the Japanese planes were on their way to bomb Pearl Harbor and bomb Wheeler Field, which was the Army Air Corps field near Schofield Barracks. So they passed over Schofield Barracks on their way for all these targets, and they were firing at any soldiers they saw. So he said, and I said, well, did you have to break into the mm-hmm. Hit the ammo? He said, yes, we did. And then he said he was on top of the roof of the barracks, and he was a Browning automatic rifleman. And so he was firing at the planes from the roof of the barracks. But he survived, and he went on to fight in all through Italy and then the Battle of the Bulge. And he came back and was a great athlete for Southern Methodist.
What sport?
He was a track and field man. He was a javelinist for Southern Methodist mm-hmm. and also a shot putter.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a big boy. Yeah.
Now, the Japanese attack, they were trying to destroy all the aircraft on the ground, too, so they couldn't go up and shoot them down.
That's right.
So it was a chaotic scene, I'm sure.
Chaotic.
And I guess surprise attack is the best way to describe it.
That's right.
Everybody was caught off guard on this.
And we didn't know whether our brother Richard was alive or dead.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't until much later.
Yeah. Now, what was this installation at Diamond Head?
That was the Army Command Center. It was the Diamond Head is an extinct volcano, and underneath Diamond Head, it's a fortification. It's all concrete bunkers and stuff, and that's where the command center was for the Army, and that's where my brother was stationed for that.
Well, that was secure, I guess.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Now, your artwork often comes from your many travels, and I know you and Carol are world travelers, and your passport probably has a lot of stamps on it.
Yes.
So how many countries have you visited? Have you ever counted them?
No, I really haven't, but it's like just a lot of countries in the East and Europe, of course. We went on a cruise from Auckland, New Zealand to Bangkok, Thailand. And it was like a 44-day cruise. I did a whole bunch of ink and watercolor sketches during that trip, which I was on Oceania cruises, and I understand that prints of my schedules were in the boardroom at the Oceania headquarters. But I talked to the CEO of Oceania, and I said, we just love that trip so much, we didn't want to get off the ship. And he said, well, if you had stayed on any longer, we'd have had to make you part of the crew.
So I guess did you stop at a lot of islands then?
Komodo Island and a lot of Indonesian Bali, and but of course all over Australia. It was just very very nice trip, and I did art the whole time I was there.
So you traveled with all your gear then?
Well, no. What I do is. I paint normally with acrylic on canvas, and that would be impossible to try to paint when you're on a trip like that with acrylic on canvas, but that takes longer to do. But what I do on a trip, I carry a spiral watercolor pad, like a 5x8 spiral watercolor pad, and my trusty watercolors, like 24 palette watercolor and my brushes and then pen and ink. And so I'll do sketches on the trip. But I'll do the start of the sketch, and then I'll come back in the stateroom and finish it off in the evening. And so I've got all kinds of books of watercolor sketches, ink and watercolor sketches. In fact, I was supposed to do a class in ink and watercolor art at the University of Evansville, but that's been postponed now because of the virus.
Now, you do have your artwork. It's on display in a number of countries. How did that come about?
Well, people have seen my artwork and have wanted to buy it. Or sometimes I'll give a print or something like that. For example, there was a church down in Thursday Island, which is off the coast of northern coast of Australia. Beautiful little Catholic church. And I did a painting of that church. And I thought, you know, maybe the church could use something. So I sent them a signed print of that. And they just were just delighted they were going to put that up, you know, their little Thursday Island church. So that's how my artwork gets around some way, you know.
And it's your artwork's in public buildings?
Yes, yes.
In Evansville and other places.
Yeah, well, for example, I've got artwork over at Old National Bank. And in the courts building, and Vectren, so you know.
I understand. I've seen some of your work of the Harlaxton campus.
Yes.
In England.
Yes.
So were you over there?
I've never been to Harlaxton, but several years ago I was asked by the Harlaxton Society to do a commission work of Harlaxton Manor, and I could work from photographs and of course I. When I do art, I normally put people in the painting because that's what makes it interesting. And so I worked on this painting, and even we went over to the East Coast, and I took the painting with me to work on it while we were on the East Coast. And the easel turned over in Virginia, and I thought I'd lost this painting. The canvas was stretched, but Carol had a way of figuring out how to restretch the canvas, and so we saved the painting. Anyhow, that painting was then completed, and it was sold at auction by the Harlaxton Society. And then I did a number of prints of that for fundraising for UE, University of Evansville. Mm-hmm. In fact, this morning I was just contacted by University of Evansville that they'd like to maybe have another fundraiser with using that same image of the Harlaxton Manor.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, also, you were an athletic guy. You started running.
Yes.
But you didn't start running until 1972, is that right?
That's right, because my kids said, Dad, you better get with it and do some athletics. They didn't want me to die of a heart attack or something. So that's when I took up running. As such, and then we came down to Evansville, and I ran races here, and then I decided that running was a little too hard on the bod, so I figured out how to do race walking, and that's what I went into was race walking.
I don't think we ever established how you got to Evansville.
Oh no, we didn't. Okay,
I think we passed over that. Okay, got to go back.
Okay,
okay.
After I came back from Germany, I was married then to Carol, and she's from St. Louis. So I went down to Austin,
Texas.
Well, let's
go. Where'd you meet Carol?
In Heidelberg, Germany.
Oh, was she doing there?
She was working a civil service position as a program director for the Army Special Services. And that's where they have a service club where she would have conduct tours and work with the GIs, kind of, not USO, but it's a service organization. That's where I met her, because I would go in there to the service club and play piano with a jazz group, and so that's how I got to know her. Then every once in a while, she might have a show that would come through that needed an accompanist, so I would do the accompaniment for them. So
that's great.
So then we were married in Heidelberg, Germany. Mm-hmm. At the Holy Ghost Church, the Heilige Geistkirche. And that was interesting because here's this medieval church. And we asked the German minister, how many other American couples have been married here? And he said, you're the first. And we said, really? And he said, I said, why? And he said, well, nobody else ever asked. And so here we were in this magnificent
wow.
church. Anyhow, so we were married in Germany, came back to, and then I went to law school at the University of Texas in Austin. Finished law school, and my father-in-law said, well, why don't you come to Missouri, they're from St. Louis, and see if you can take the Missouri bar. And I said, okay. So we went up there, and I took the Missouri bar, passed it, and then practiced law in St. Louis from like 64 to 77, and then and both in private practice and also as corporate attorney. And I worked for Peabody Coal Company for several years, and then I worked as general counsel for a company called Arch Mineral Corporation. Mm-hmm. And then when I there was a startup company, a coal company called Pardee Corporation. It was going to have its offices down in Evansville, and they asked me to go with it to be the general counsel. So I said, okay, but I knew these guys from my days with Peabody and Arch Mineral. So that was like 78. So he came down, and we worked for several years, and then the inflation was double digit, and the company just got phased out. So at that point, I said to my family, I said, well, do they want to stay in Evansville or they want to go back to St. Louis? And our kids, our two daughters went to University of Evansville and our son went to Evansville Day School. And they said, we like Evansville. Let's stay here. And so I said, okay, then I got to go get a job. So that's when I went back into private practice in Evansville. And I practiced law in Evansville until 2002.
What firm?
Well, I was with Bowers Harrison, Kenton Miller, mm-hmm. and for most of the time, yeah.
And you said you worked downtown.
Yeah. We were in the IBM building.
Which is our neighbor.
Yes, there. Right next door. Yeah. Yeah.
Right on the riverfront.
Yes.
Now, you play an instrument, or several instruments.
Yes. I practice once a year now. You know, I'm really, really bad. I've been doing so much art. But, I play the piano. String bass, guitar, and banjo, and also, of course, ukulele.
Well, of course. And, well, you have to explain the shirt you're wearing right now.
Yes.
It's very Hawaiian.
Yes, this is it's an Aloha shirt, and it was made by a company called Ren Spooner, which is this is what the businessmen would wear in Hawaii. It's very... very nice, not touristy type thing. And this particular one is their ukulele edition. So it has pictures of ukuleles on it, including a brand called Kamaka, which is a wonderful ukulele. And I've got a Kamaka. I've got two Kamakas. I got a soprano and also a tenor. But the one about the soprano ukulele, it's really an old one. It has the outer... image of a pineapple painted on the back side of it. And how I got that one, a number of years ago when my mother passed away, at 103, by the way, they were going to have the funeral on the Oahu Cemetery in Hawaii, in Honolulu. And so my cousin, a gal who had a beautiful Hawaiian voice and singing like an angel, she was going to sing some Hawaiian songs at the graveside. And so they wanted me to play the ukulele.
Sure.
And I didn't have an ukulele with me. And so my niece had her mother's ukulele, which her mother's my sister, and who is deceased. So anyhow, she brought this ukulele, which is this Kamaka with a pineapple painted on the outside. And so I accompanying my cousin for the service. Then after the service, I was going to give this ukulele back to my niece. And she said, oh, no, Uncle Seti, that's yours. And I said, no, but this belonged to your mother. And she said, yes, but my mother would have wanted you to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went right down with Carol to the ukulele store and got a traveling case for it because it's a valuable instrument. And then so that's why I've got that kamaka.
We're talking to Cedric Huestis, a local retired attorney, artist, still working daily, really,
yes.
In his gallery, I guess, at home. And we're going to learn more about his painting routine coming up. What was the first painting he sold? And much more about Cedric Huestis and a life well lived. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and if you are just joining us, my guest is local artist Cedric Huestis. He's got a new coffee table book in the works, a collection of his paintings of Hawaii. And you have many travels in your lifetime. Your trip to India, tell us about that.
Okay, that was in 2010. It was like in December, I think, of 2010. And we were going to be there for like 3 weeks, Carol and I. And it was, we were going to go in northern India. We had been to southern India on another trip. So this is going to be northern India, Agra, the Taj Mahal, and some other places. And so we landed at New Delhi, and our luggage wasn't with us. And so we each had a suitcase. And so we inquired, you know, was it going to be getting there pretty soon? Mm-hmm. And they didn't know where it was. And so Carol's suitcase came about a week after we were in India. And we, our daughter was with us, Joan. That's the one who's the author and the photographer. Bright red hair. Yeah, and you really don't mess with a redhead, you know. Anyhow, so Joan loaned Carol some clothing. But I didn't have any clothing. My suitcase didn't show up. So I would contact Delta just about every day and say, where's the suitcase? And they were trying to track it down. Finally, towards the end of the trip, and I had to buy some clothing because I didn't have any extra clothing. And so towards the end of the trip, I talked to the Delta representative, who was very nice. And I said to her, I said, you know, I don't have any clothes. I might have to come back on the return flight dressed as Gandhi, wearing just a loincloth. And she said, Mr. Huestis, I don't think we'll let you on the plane. But the suitcase didn't arrive. We got back to Evansville. And 1 week passed, 2 weeks passed, and finally the suitcase arrived. And our daughter Joan said, Dad, before you open it, you better be careful. It may be a cobra in there, you know. And what it was, you see, because we were just going to go the next week, I was going to teach art on Oceania's newest ship, the MS Marina. And that was going to be from Genoa, Italy to San Francisco. So I didn't even have a suitcase. So anyhow, the stuff arrived and everything worked out.
Well, what would you say is the most exotic place you've ever visited?
Oh, gee. Well, I guess India was right at the top of the list. And the reason I say that is because I've done like 47 or 48 paintings of scenes in India. And so it really kind of captured my imagination, you know. India. I don't think we'll go back because it's just such a long flight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like 16 hours just across. You know, it's a long way to go. Mm-hmm. But we liked India a lot.
Some exotic foods that you've tasted.
Yeah, well, there again, India. After a while, the foods in India, I would just be happy to settle for just a bowl of soup and some bread.
Definitely. Now, is Carol an artist, your wife?
Yes, she has got a master's in art. She went to Washington University in St. Louis, And so she's got a bachelor's and a master's in art. And so she is actually my chief art critic. And I have to be careful how I say it. This is chief with an F, not cheap art critic. And so and I paint so fast that sometimes I miss things. And I say, okay, I'm done. And she, Carol says, oh, no, you're not. Now look at this, look at this, and look at this. So she calls my attention to things, and then I go back and correct it. And
so she has the credentials to be a critic.
Yes,
then.
Oh, yes.
Definitely, yes, definitely. Well, my daughter, she's an artist, and she's teaching high school now in Floyd County, Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And she's taught art history at the University of Evansville,
yes.
Adjunct faculty.
Good.
Now, as a family, we've visited art museums and at the Tate in London, and we've been to the Louvre in Paris, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg,
oh, yeah,
Russia.
Yeah.
Been to all the biggies like
sure.
that. And, of course, she's drug us along, and now we're fascinated by it, too, and we're hooked. And so she knew you were coming, and she had some questions for you.
Good.
So are you ready,
yes.
Cedric Eustace, for
you know, this is about, like the tour guide.
Yeah.
If anything I don't know, I just make up.
There you go. Okay. Now, so from one artist to another, here we go.
Okay.
Do you have any formal art education?
Okay, yes, I do. I studied during undergraduate school some art. And actually, my mother was very artistically inclined. And she told me that when I was going to go to undergraduate school, she said I could take as many art and music theory courses as I wanted, just as long as I didn't major in either. So I would pick up a art class here and there. Mm-hmm. And I had, for example, the University of Miami in the summertime, I took a figure drawing class. And Carol wants to know all about it because they had a live model, see.
Well, they have the nude models, right.
I said the guy was really a nice guy. We had a lot of good conversations, you know.
Sure.
And
I mean, that's part of it.
I know. But then when I was over in Heidelberg, Germany, there was a German artist, and I studied under him. And he was just very, very helpful. The guy had been a Panzer tank driver in World War II, so he really had many stories.
Oh, I bet.
But he was a good artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, she wanted to know if you do the gamut, portraits, landscapes, plein air, sculpture?
No sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
I have done plein air.
Mm-hmm. Explain plein air.
Well, it's where you sit outside and have a blank canvas. And then you're sitting there and see a scene, and then you paint the scene while you're outside,
mm-hmm.
and you're in the open air, you mm-hmm. know. But which is okay. I did that when there was a gallery here, a wonderful gallery, Riverwind Gallery, and they would have a plein air paint out type thing,
mm-hmm.
and then that was a lot of fun. But I normally don't do that. Now there's a place up in Rockport. It's the Lincoln Log Cabin Museum.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yes.
And I've been up there quite a bit. I've done some paintings of their various buildings, and they wanted me to come out for a function to sit outside and paint. And there I might do it as a fundraiser. I might paint some quick ink and watercolor sketches and then sell them to people. And then the money would go to the mm-hmm. museum,
mm-hmm.
But that's all been put on hold because of the virus, you know.
Now, my daughter also wanted to know about the first painting that you sold.
Gosh, that was so long ago, I can't even remember. But I do remember selling my first commission work in Evansville, and that was to an attorney by the name of Doug Briotti, a nice guy. He was a practice in my law firm, and he commissioned me to do a painting of the Greyhound bus station. So he has the original, and then there's a big print of that one that's at Vectren.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first commission work that I sold here.
Now, so other artists who have influenced you, and we've talked about Van Gogh.
Van Gogh, yeah. You know, I there were... I can't tell you all of the artists, but we were in France last summer, and at the Rouen Museum, mm-hmm. and there were some impressionists that I'd never even heard of, and they did beautiful work, and so I really drink it all in and try to figure out what they do and how to paint, you know, mm-hmm. but I can't.
Are you always learning?
Yeah, always, and I always thinking. Really, what I'm doing, you know, I don't like to go down, like have a wrong turn, you know, and have to backtrack. I'm 86 now, and I don't want to waste any time, in doing something that's not going to work out. So I think about what I'm going to do. In advance, and plan accordingly. And I did a large painting of the military, the services. I had done it originally. I thought maybe Old National was interested, but then they had a change of plans, so they didn't take it. But they liked it. But that one has finally wound up. On the East Coast, at our grandson who flies for the Navy, but that one required a lot of planning, a lot of sketches, so that everything would hang together. There was a lot going on in the painting.
I think that might have answered this question. She said my daughter wanted to know if you could walk us through the creative process.
Oh yeah, well, for example, if I use a lot of photography. I mean, I take my own photographs. And let's say that I was going to have a picture of a village or something like that. Okay, let's say a village. So I had a photograph that I would like to use, and so I'll get that the right size so it's going to fit whatever canvas I'm going to use, and then sometimes I will get a print of that painting, a print of that photograph, put it on a sheet, and then cover it with a tracing paper. And then on the tracing paper, I'll sketch other things I want in the painting, like people walking, mm-hmm. Dogs, animals, horses, people riding horses. And so then I'll sketch that where I'm gonna put it in the painting. And then I'll get the canvas, the actual canvas, and I'll graph the canvas with chalk and then draw all the what I'm going to put on the painting in chalk, and including the stuff that I have put on the tracing paper, so I know everything is going to fit. I'm not going to run out of canvas. And I noticed in Europe, we were in what had been East Germany, and someone had done a portrait of some prince or count or something like that, and it was a nice portrait, and the with the armor and things like that, but the artist had run out of canvas so that the head was too small, you know? So I never want to get to that point.
Right. Oh, my goodness. So now she wanted to know what your palette looks like.
Oh, well, I'm what they call a colorist.
Okay.
I do a lot of work with a lot of bright colors. Nothing is drab. You know, I don't lead a drab life, and I don't do drab paintings, and the palette itself, the actual physical palette, I work with tear off papers that I can put my acrylics on that, and then when I finish doing a painting one day, I can tear off a sheet and then start with a fresh palette. I don't have to worry about washing off a palette, but I would say it has I like reds, all types of reds. And I, of course, greens are wonderful. And maybe that's from Hawaii because I can, all the vibrant greens. So I've got and I never put on a color that's just by itself. I always mix colors. And that's the cardinal principle. You never put something out of the tube, you know.
Yeah. Now, when you do portraits, do you have people sitting or do you do it from a photograph?
A photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I take my own photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is strictly my...
So somebody comes in and...
Yeah, or I go to them and and take photographs. And the one who has had the most portraits done is Carol. She has had, I think I've done 5 or 6 portraits of Carol at various times in her life. And the latest one was last summer when we were on the Seine River, and she's sitting there with a big broad hat, and it looks like Carol, and, you know. So, yeah, but that's how I do it, with photographs.
So where can people see your works?
Oh, well, sometimes I enter shows, but I'm almost getting to the point where I don't even want to enter a exhibit, maybe, and this is a solo show, you know, then I'll do it. But they can see it on Facebook, and a lot of times I post just about every day. Like today I posted one of the Iolani barracks.
I saw that one.
Yeah, and then tomorrow I probably will post one of the Hilo Fish Market in Hawaii. But then I probably will have a hiatus for a little bit because I'll be working on the book. Mm-hmm. So there may not be any more postings. But they can go to Facebook and see probably my old postings, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
What's the title of this book?
Well,
have you got a title yet?
I was going to call it Hawaii Memories, but I don't know if that's, you know, set in concrete.
Mm-hmm. Work in progress on the title,
yes,
then.
Yes,
all
yes.
Right. Cedric Huestis, artist, race walker, attorney, musician, bon vivant, a world traveler. Thank you so much for being my guest on 2 Main Street. This has been a pleasure.
Oh, same here.
Thanks
so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks, Cedric.
Bye.
Remember Jade and Amber? Well, there's a painting of the playful Whippet sisters hanging over the fireplace at the Huestis home. Cedric describes them as 35-mile-per-hour couch potatoes. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.